Hello, everyone, and welcome to tonight's show. The date is Wednesday, the 4th of March, 2020. We are now live on the Tim Wilms YouTube and DLive channel. It's the Wilms Front episode you've all been demanding. Plenty of you in the live chat in previous shows have wanted me to discuss the federal government's proposed cash ban on cash transactions over 10,000 Australian dollars. We are told the cash ban is necessary in the fight against organised crime, but it sounds more like a ploy to push us into a cashless society where the banks and government can keep a log of all our digital transactions. I have been keeping up to speed with the what's called the currency restrictions on the use of cash bill 2019. Just last Friday, the Senate Economics Committee released its findings on the bill. An economics expert who has been warning Australians of the significance and danger of the cash ban, while the mainstream media has been ignoring it, is Martin North, who runs Digital Finance Analytics, which is a website and a YouTube channel which has over 30,000 subscribers. Martin also covers the turbulence of global stock markets, the manipulations of our currencies by central banks, and all manner of speculative bubbles. On his channel, he also hosts the Adams North Report with John Adams, who's a former coalition government advisor who I've interviewed previously. Martin, welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
So we'll start with the rationale for the cash ban. It seems to be the responsibility of the Assistant Treasurer Michael Sukkar at the moment to basically make the pitch for this. I gave a brief rationale for it, but can you go into detail?
Well, a bit of history first. So you need to understand that the cash ban, deposit bail-in, and some of the other things that are going on are all an agenda that was cooked up post the G20 meeting back in 2011. So after the global financial crisis, where effectively banks were basically rescued by governments putting huge amount of taxpayers' money into them around the world, right? G20 were looking for an alternative. They didn't want to throw more public money at saving banks down the track. Now, one of the things that was recommended was that effectively there should be more controls, and the cash thing is part of that story. Now, there was also a Black Economy Task Force that ran in Australia a few years later. That was led by KPMG and a few other people. And the Black Economy Task Force basically incorporated the idea of a transaction cash ban in their recommendations. And those recommendations were brought into Parliament by Scott Morrison when he was Treasurer. So Scott Morrison is all over this bill, as is the G20. So that's the important context. So whenever people decide to resist this, we are resisting not only ScoMo, but also the G20. So that's important to understand, right? So the bill was introduced, the cash bill particularly, was introduced last year. And Treasury were responsible for propagating it. They actually issued the draft bill on a Friday night at 5:30 p.m. with no more than 2 weeks to put submissions in. And despite that, I think they all hoped that no one would notice, we managed to get 3,500 submissions into Treasury relating to the cash bill. And basically, the bulk of them were actually anti the bill. And we'll talk about why in a second, right? And then it went into the lower house, so they redrafted a little bit, but went into the lower house. The lower house voted it through in November time. It then went to the Senate, and the Senate decided to hold an inquiry into the bill. And the inquiry received more than 2,500 submissions. So in both, you know, normally these submissions, people receive 20 or 30 submissions, vast numbers of submissions, right? And the bill was reported then back from the Senate last week with some sort of 5 or 6 key recommendations to make changes to the bill. But essentially, the cornerstone is that if those changes were made, it would be potentially actually introduced into law. But what this bill says is that it is not allowable to make any cash transactions above $10,000, period, in Australia. Right, that's what the bill says. And then there's a separate set of regulations that carve out specific exclusions. So, for example, there's an exclusion that says cryptocurrencies are okay at the moment. transactions between up to $10,000 and more are okay in the bank, between a bank and a consumer and a consumer at a bank, right? So, but those regulations are not in the bill. Those regulations can be changed at any time by the treasurer just striking it out and saying, right, we're going to use something different, right? So the bill is banning all transactions with more than $10,000 in cash. Now, it's being argued that this is to do with the black economy and tax leakage. Actually, Australia has a very small proportion of its economy that has tax leakage, and most of the tax leakage is not down at sort of $10,000 cash. It's more to do with multinationals. If you look at the big multinationals who don't pay their tax here, it's billions and billions and billions they don't pay, right? But nevertheless, they've chosen to focus on this narrow element. Now, the point about this is the rationale that they put out is it's all about tax leakage and tax minimization and clamping down on biker gangs. That's what Suka says, right? Who's now responsible for it, as you said. But if you look carefully, go back to G20, go back to what I said, what I think they've got is a mechanism that if they needed to, in a crisis, in a banking crisis, they could essentially, if this bill was law, turn off cash withdrawals from banks. In other words, this is a mechanism that potentially has the opportunity of stopping money being whipped out of the banks in a crisis. Now, if you go back to 2008 UK, look at Northern Rock, one of the building societies over there. There were queues of people down the street all whipping out their money out of the Northern Rock because they were worried about its financial stability. Right? They didn't want this to happen again. That's what the G20 was on about. That's what this cash bin bill effectively can be about. So that's what this real agenda is. Now, the story, therefore, is that you've now got some politicians across the aisle who are very negative this bill and actually believe that it erodes civil liberties, because at the moment you can actually use cash the way you want it. Post the bill coming in, you won't be able to use cash in certain ways. There are also other people who are arguing that it's to do with monetary policy and negative interest rates and all those sorts of things, right? So if you actually are persuaded by just the black economy arguments, the other point to make is that around the world, the cash level has tended to be dropping lower and lower. So rather it might be $10,000 now, but it could well be dropped lower later as well. In some countries in Europe where they've got a similar bill, it's 1,000 or 2,000 euros. So this is a way of controlling the money supply, controlling the way we use cash, eroding our civil liberties, and very importantly, building a trap which could be activated in the case of a financial crisis.
And that's why I thought it was interesting that it came from the G20, because you and I both remember the global financial crisis. And after that, there was the European banking crisis, which affected Greece and Cyprus. And obviously, with people worried about the banks' liquidity, is they want to withdraw their money. And they introduced things such as extra bank holidays so that you can't go to the bank and there's a limit on how much you can withdraw from the ATMs, because just to a lot of people in the chat might know this as well, we have a fractional reserve banking system where the bank loans out your money that it stores, and that gets deposited again. And so it only has, 10% deposit on hand.
Well, it depends whether you believe the fractional reserve theory of how banks work, right? So that's a whole other argument. We can go down that route if you want, because it's really important to understand that banks have the ability to create unlimited amounts of credit, right? It's not linked by the amount of deposits they have. What happens is that they actually can create money out of thin air when they write a loan. Those loans then go and create assets or create deposits. Those deposits then go into the banking system, right? So this whole idea of the banking system is limited in some way by those ratios and that fractional reserve is not actually in fact the way banks work. Banks can grow for as long as people can be persuaded to borrow more from them.
The reason why I mentioned it is because this is another reason why both the banks and the governments don't want people to withdraw their money on a mass scale, because then the banks go bankrupt. Yep. And the whole fractional reserve system of banking collapses.
So that's right. Banks have to have assets and liabilities. So, you know, the loans on one side, the deposits on the other side, deposits and also other forms of funding, for example, bonds and those sorts of things, right? They have to keep the two together. So the more they loan, the more they have to have the other side of the balance sheets. Now, if in fact people whip out a whole bunch of their savings from the banks, then they're ratios go all over the place, and then they can't lend anymore and get into liquidity risk areas. And that's precisely the problem with this. So in a way, the cash ban is a way of trying, I think, to lock people into the banking system to protect the banks. And that has been ultimately denied again and again by even the Senate inquiry, refused to make that connection. So they're sort of going back to, no, this is all about tax leakage and black economy, right? They're missing the elephant in the room, which is monetary policy and the need to actually keep people within the banking system. And the real truth is that once you are in the banking system, the only way that you can transact then is digitally. Every time you transact digitally, you create a footprint, and that basically means that you can be tracked. People can understand precisely what it is that you're doing, and it's a bit like 1984. Nothing is free, because if you think about it, cash transactions, it's just notes, right? And there's no audit trail. But if you're actually making payments within the digital system, then you leave a footprint, and that basically leaves open control. And worse. So that's another angle on this, right? So it's almost a strategy to push more and more into the digital world and to lock people into the digital system. And it's about surveillance and supervision and all those things. And in fact, China is a really interesting model, because they've taken this a lot further. You have things like social scores there and all those things. But basically, the financial system is much more controlled than here. But we have a heavily controlled financial system now. And the worry about the cash ban is it's just one more step taking away our freedoms again.
Yeah, because it's privileging the banks even more. Which, who issues the banking licenses? It's the government, and of course the big four banks. They want to retain their privileges and make sure that there's no competition. And of course, governments, and we have the financial transactions regulator AUSTRAC, who do their credit, do uncover some dirty deals by the bank, but the government wants the ability, not that they're looking at it all, but the ability to basically go through someone's financial footprint. And it's easier if there's just four banks which people are locked into.
Well, there's no doubt that competitive dynamics around banking is worrying, right? So we have a large number of very small players and a small number of very large players. And in fact, APRA has some time ago said it's much more convenient if we have all of our financial system in a small number of players that we can easily supervise, right? So there is endorsement, if you like, at the center of large is good and a small number is good, right? When in fact what we should be doing is encouraging significantly greater competition. The margins in Australia even now are a lot higher than most banks around the world. So Australian Inc. is paying very heavily for our uncompetitive monopolistic type behaviours from the banking sector. And yet they're protected by government. They're protected by the Reserve Bank. The Reserve Bank has something called the Committed Liquidity Facility, which basically says if banks get into issue in difficulty from a liquidity perspective, the Reserve Bank will support them and help them. And in fact, one of the reasons why the credit ratings of the banks here in Australia are so strong is because there is the belief that the banks will be absolutely supported by the government and by the Reserve Bank.
One of the developments that we've covered here at The Unshackled is the big banks, primarily ANZ and Westpac, deplatforming Patriot, shutting down their bank account in a clause in their terms of conditions. It's basically for wrongthink. And we have this cash ban coming in. We have, as you just said, everyone wants there to be these big privileged banks. And so if you get deplatformed from one of the banks for wrong thing, that is a serious hindrance on basically your everyday life to financially trade, just to buy things at the grocery store. Even if there is toilet paper, the banks will cancel your card. And obviously the Stripe and PayPal and other payment processes have deplatformed lots of people for wrong think, mainly on the right. And so this is basically consolidating it more, where they're basically keeping you in line that, yeah, you can't even go back to cash, which is legal tender, it says on that.
Well, so legal tender today is legal, you know, and you can tender with it, but the cash bill will change that, right? And you're absolutely right. So there was evidence produced in the inquiry for the cash bill of debanking, in other words, businesses being effectively unable to continue because their banking services were being removed by the banks. And they didn't have to give any explanation as to why it was that they were actually doing that. There is no civil right to allow you access to the banking system. It is a commercial relationship. It's a commercial decision that the banks make. And their argument would be that if it's not commercially sensible for them to do it, they won't do it. And that means, you know, commercially sensible from a profit perspective or from a moral perspective or from a political perspective. So we are already teetering on the edge of effectively the banking system having significant veto control over people being able to live, you know, a reasonable life. And the fact is, if you can't use cash and you are being forced into the banking system, right, you've got no choice. They have control. The other thing, of course, is they can charge you fees. Because if you think about it, if you pay with some of the online systems, then you may have to pay a fee. Or if you have digital accounts, they'll start charging you for them. So this is potentially another earner for the banks as well. So effectively, the more you're forced into the banking system, the more you're playing effectively their game, the more they're going to charge you, the more they're going to be in control, and the less flexibility and freedom we have as individuals. And it's interesting that some of the liberals, for example, down in Melbourne, actually have identified this freedom issue as the critical one. So basically they're saying this is anti-liberal. This liberals don't stand for this. They stand for individual freedom and flexibility and agility, all those good things. This is precisely the opposite. So effectively you could argue that the Morrison government doctrinally has gone completely off the rails.
Yeah, because the Liberal Party now does have a, you'd call it a substantial amount of classical liberal libertarian MPs, Tim Wilson, James Patterson, come to mind. And this is the ultimate restriction on civil liberties, your ability to trade, do transactions in legal tender. But you mentioned there that this was signed off by Scott Morrison when he was the treasurer. Obviously, Josh Frydenberg is the treasurer now. And you mentioned the regulations which the treasurer can change with the stroke of a pen. And if he's captured by his treasury department, the bureaucracy already run the show most of the time. And if they capture a minister, even better for them, but it just shows that when politicians get into cabinet and that, Scott Morrison himself talks about the political bubble. Well, this backbench revolt hasn't changed his cabinet's policy on this one iota.
No, well, there's actually a very interesting tussle going on. So we know that there are a number of liberals and nationals who are very anti this bill. We also know that some of the Labour Party people are anti. The Greens are against it. One Nation are very against it too. But within his own party, there are people who are against it. But Morrison, Frydenberg and Suker have basically been holding the line. And in fact, the inside talk is that it's Morrison who's saying, no, we must do this. Of course, he's the one who built it. Brought the bill in the first place. And it goes right back to, the reason is because it connects back to the G20 and the international agenda about protecting the banking system from another financial crisis like a decade ago. And of course, the timing on this couldn't be more worrying given where we are over the last few days with all of the falls in the financial markets, the pressure on the banking system because of the coronavirus, and the fact that probably some of their customers will have difficulty in repaying the loans they've got. I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons why this is almost a replay of the GFC a decade ago from a liquidity perspective. So this is really a very, very current issue. And you know, the worrying thing here is that many of the politicians have no idea. So even those who voted for it in the lower house, many of them had no idea that the penalty here is up to 2 years in jail if you make a cash transaction above $10,000, right? That's the penalty. That's the most draconian, regulation compared with almost everybody around the world with regard to this. And they've gone black letter. In other words, it's not about the circumstance. In other words, did you make a mistake? Have you done it several times? It's basically, if you make a transaction more than $10,000 in cash, you can go to jail.
There would be people who would say, and it sort of feels like they're the old assault rifle argument, why do you need to make cash transactions over $10,000? For example, ATMs, they only dispense $50 bills, even though we have $100 bills. And whenever we see somebody, a lot of people, when they see someone flash a $100 greenback bill, they sort of, well, how did you get that? Were you up to something? So why is it necessary there's obviously the freedom principle argument, but also the practicalities as well. What may you like to purchase for more than $10,000 with cash?
Well, yeah, so there are some areas. So if you go look up in some of the rural areas, for example, they don't have at the moment the ability to use electronic alternatives. So, you know, if they're buying cattle or selling cattle at a market, evidently, you know, cash is used quite often for that. It is also used in other. So there was actually an interesting evidence argument produced by the funeral directors of Australia, who said, you know, it's amazing how many people save for their funeral, you know, notes over time. And then when they die, they turn up with this big bundle of notes to pay for the funeral. So there are lots of examples where cash is legitimately used. Now, I recognise that there will be a small proportion of people who are using cash for, you know, nefarious means and that sort of thing. But there are already regulations today that, if they were enforced, would actually restrict those sorts of transactions. You don't need another bill to do this, right? You just need the implementation of the current legislative frameworks that are already in place. And Andrew Wilkie in the lower house made the point when he was arguing against the bill, said, if you actually had been implementing and policing the current regulations that exist in Australia, you wouldn't need another cash ban bill, right? So it's about, you know, is this overkill? And yes, it is. And is it to do with this, you know, broader question of monetary and control and that sort of thing? Yes, it is. But even if you stand back and just look at it as a single piece of legislation relating specific to cash transactions, we know that there are many people who use cash today quite legitimately. We know that there are many people who prefer to use cash rather than digital. And that's going to probably continue for some time. And there are circumstances, for example, we had the South Coast where we had the bushfires and all of the ATMs, ATM networks, and all of the FPOS machines went offline for weeks. The only way you could buy anything in those areas was using cash. Right? So there is a very, very important role for cash, even in a case of emergency. And so I think that we need to be very careful not just to sort of be bounced into this very, very draconian environment where effectively cash is now illegal in certain circumstances.
And if people are engaging in illegal activities with transactions over 10,000, are they suddenly going to think, oh, I better not engage in this illegal transaction now because now the cash transfer itself would be illegal, which goes to your point. Of course, agencies, law enforcement, they're always wanting extra power, not because it will help them catch them, but it's basically they just want it there.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt. Yeah, there's no doubt that there is this sort of quest for power. And in fact, you could list a whole bunch of regulations over the last 5 years that have taken away more and more of our freedoms. Look at some of the digital changes that were made. Look at some of the digital identity. Look at the credit scoring system that's now in. So little by little, our freedoms are being eroded. And frankly, I'm worried that we're just sleepwalking into, you know, a nightmare solution into the future where effectively every action that we take, everything that we spend our money on is controlled and managed at the center. And I'm very worried by that. And I think that's something we should be resisting, right? First point. Second point is this $10,000 limit thing, right? That's just a number plucked out of the air because the Treasury in their evidence to the Senate said, well, we didn't quite know where to set it. We picked it because it was a convenient level, right? Because it's the same as the AUSTRAC one. But like I said earlier on, around the world, typically the cash ban limit gets dropped, right? €1,000 to €2,000. In other words, not $10,000, but $1,000, right? What would happen if it was $1,000? Think how restrictive that would be in terms of, you know, just day-to-day transactions. So the difficulty is that this is the thin end of the wedge. And yet, you know, frankly, many people have been, I think, are ignorant of this. I'd also say that the mainstream media have hardly covered this at all.
Oh, yeah, right, there's been a disgrace on it. Yep. And we just saw yesterday Australian Associated Press announcing their closure and all these people sobbing on Twitter that we won't get impartial, important news anymore. But there's been a report here and there, but there has been in no way a write-up about how significant if this bill passed, it would be. It's just like, oh, the Senate committee is considering this. It's just sort of basically page 12 of the paper.
Yeah, well, there's a few things to say there. ABC did do an article a few months ago, but the journalist who did it got into terrible trouble because basically she took a stronger position than people wanted her to take. Other than that, there's a guy called Aaron Patrick over at the AFR who's written three very, very disgusting articles, basically accusing, this being a right-wing plot. In other words, should let the cash ban come in. It's make perfectly sensible. Anybody who's resisting it is, you know, a right-wing, plotter, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, the AFR is the public organ of the banking system, so wouldn't worry too much about that. Although, I think I may have mentioned this, Alan Jones did do a very good piece on Sky yesterday where he basically was talking to Malcolm Robertson from the One Nation Party who's resisted it. And Alan was right on song, highlighting all of the risks and issues around this and talking about, you know, civil liberties and talking about the issue of being trapped in the banking system and talking about the lack of civil liberties that effectively this would lead us to. And, you know, kudos to him. He's finally got on song. It's just 6 months too late.
Yeah, Alan, when he does get onto an issue such as this, which is ignored by the mainstream, he's incredibly effective. They talk about his power is overstated to his enemies, but he has led some important campaigns over the years, and well, better late than never.
Well, you know, the more the merrier, right? And the other interesting thing is we've got quite a few people internationally who are watching what's happening here in Australia. So there are some very, very famous people who are now engaging around this. And some of the posts that I've done on Walk the World, which is my YouTube channel, we've had a whole big audience, 80, 90, 100 something thousand of people around the world, and a lot of interest because this battle is actually not just representing Australia and Australians, but it's also a battle which potentially is going to be played out elsewhere around the world because this G20 logic is not just for an Australian banking system. It's for every banking system around the world, controlled by the central bankers, controlled through the G20, controlled by the Financial Stability Board. And so other countries are watching with interest to what extent we battle this. It's also worth saying Germany tried to put this bill in about 4 or 5 years ago, and ultimately it was rejected because one of the main papers, the newspapers in Germany, came out against it and basically ran a very effective campaign, and it was derailed. Most other places across Europe have this legislation in place now. And, you know, it is very interesting to see that in other countries where it's not yet in, but there is talk about it being brought in, Australia is being held out as a bit of a case study.
Will the cash ban apply to political donations in Aldi bags?
No, politicians are exempt.
Yes, because when we've seen constantly when they're caught with their expenses, they say, "Oh, it was technically within the rules or guidelines." I get confused what's the difference between rules and guidelines, and everyone rightly points out that if we did that, we'd be before the courts.
Yep. Now, there's one rule for them and one rule for everybody else, right? The fact of the matter is that there are specific carves out in the bill, right? So anybody in the political environment, anything in public life, basically, no, you can do whatever you like, right?
Really? I was just making a joke, but that actually is in there.
It is. Absolutely, it is. It is. Absolutely. Oh. And so basically, if you are, you know, a small business, right, or if you're an individual and, you know, you actually want to pay in cash over $10,000, you won't be allowed to. But if you're in a political party or if you're in the, you know, political establishment, not a problem.
Oh. Another thing's come to mind when the good guys, the electrical retailer, launched. Their slogan was "Pay cash and we'll slash the prices," because obviously there's no merchant fees there. And I remember this was way back in 2008 when I bought my first flat screen HD TV. I paid for that in cash. So I guess that sort of deal where you both the good guys, in both senses of the word, that sort of deal, cutting out the middleman, is going to be gone. Well, if you're getting a TV that's over $10,000.
Well, that's the whole point. So basically the idea is that people do pay cash sometimes, and it's a negotiating ploy, right? Because you can actually sometimes get a better deal because, as you said, there are no merchant fees that need to be paid. Now, the argument that the other side will put is, well, if you're paying cash, just, you know, let's say you have a tradesman turn up and fix your roof, right? And you offer to pay cash. Does that tradesman then actually declare that revenue when he does his accounts? But my argument is that's not the person who's paid's problem, that's the tradesman's problem, right? Because basically you are policing effectively, you know, one thing to try and solve another problem. Clearly, if the audit and account of that particular business is done right, then that would be picked up. So trying to effectively put the acid back on the individual for something which is relating to the way that the tradesman runs his own business, to me, is misplaced.
You mentioned that the cash ban doesn't apply to cryptocurrencies, which are completely decentralized. So the AUSTRAC, even if they wanted to, it's a lost cause. But before we had crypto, there was the gold bugs, because if you had stocks in gold or actually had gold and precious metals, because it guards against inflation. Gold always goes up, but there have been instances in the past where governments have actually banned gold. Franklin Roosevelt during Great Depression, World War II, did that. What is the status of that in Australia, precious metals?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, there is an act in Australia, the 1959 Act, which says that the government can confiscate gold at any time, at any price. Put that in the back of your mind, right? So basically, what it says is that if you're using gold for, you know, things like jewellery and those sorts of things, that isn't included. But if you're using it as a medium of exchange, in other words, actually as a currency, potentially it could be caught. There is no clarity at the moment in the legislation precisely about that. The carve-out, so those regulations, it sort of mentions it a little bit, but not specifically. And it's not, in my view, it's not very clear as to whether gold is or isn't included. Cryptos, at the moment, it is carved out, and they basically said, well, at the moment, cryptos is relatively small as a proportion of total transactions, so therefore we'll exclude it. But they left the door open that if cryptos start to take off, then they can apply the same transaction ban to cryptos as they can to other types. Doesn't need to change the law, because the crypto is actually in the regulation, which can be changed by the Treasury at any time. So cryptos aren't safe. I don't think gold is safe. And other precious metals, and you know, it is just showing you that this is, you know, tentacles getting around lots of different parts of society.
Well, if they can confiscate your gold at any time, do they have to provide monetary compensation, or do they just...
At whatever price they want.
So
it's not at a market price.
Now let's move on now to we've talked about the big banks but let's talk about the central banks now. Obviously, you mentioned Reserve Bank of Australia, which issues Australia's currency and also sets interest rates, and the Reserve Bank of Australia, which is independent from government, lowered our interest rates yet again to 0.5%. They said to basically make sure the economy keeps floating along with the coronavirus panic that is sweeping the nation at the moment, which they're worried will lead to a recession next quarter. But the Reserve Bank also said previously that they were considering taking matters into their own hands to introduce what the US Federal Reserve has done for decades, quantitative easing, which is just a nice word for printing money, inflating the money supply, and robbing us of our wealth. It's called the secret tax inflation to prop up the economy through that. And we know that Trump has been, in his re-election year, is wanting the Fed, he actually tweeted today, he wants them to keep cutting and easing.
Yeah, so this whole issue of central banks and their role is one that concerns me greatly, because essentially the central banks ostensibly are independent but aren't really. I mean, in the US, the Federal Reserve is a privately owned institution owned by the major banks. So it's not a government entity, right? The RBA in Australia is not the same structure at all. It is actually a public entity, so it's part of the government structure. So if you think about it, you've got Treasury and the government over here, you've got the Reserve Bank. They all sit around the table, by the way, in this thing called the Council of Financial Regulators with ASIC and APRA. So that you know, the idea of them being independent is nuts. They are actually all part of this same cabal at the centre, right? And so they're basically calling the shots in terms of monetary policy and other things. The quantitative easing, which has been going on for a long, long time, where, as you say, they basically buy assets, and that can be treasury bills, bonds, it can be mortgage-backed securities. In Japan, they buy stocks and shares from the stock market as well. So, you know, the central bank's balance sheet gets bigger and bigger and bigger. As a result of that, they basically create more liquidity, which goes back into the banking system, increasing the money supply. That means that effectively the value of everything is degraded. So effectively, whilst the value goes up, it's actually degrading it. So, you know, there are more millionaires today than there was a decade ago, but everything's just more expensive. So it's an illusion. It's not real, right? So what we're actually doing is we're devaluing the effective value of the currency that we've actually got at the moment. So effectively, that's the first point. The second point is there is no limit to the amount of quantitative easing that can be done until the currency is derailed by it. And you might like to know that the Fed has, in the last 6 months, increased their balance sheet by $600 billion, right, in 6 months. That balance sheet is now as big as it's pretty much ever been and will continue to grow as they take interest rates lower. So we're on this sort of doom loop of lower interest rates, more quantitative easing. And if you look at Japan and if you look at the European Union, where they've been at this a long time, in Europe, the interest rate baseline is below negative. So effectively, the central bank is charging banks when they hold money at the central bank. And in Germany now, retail deposit holders are being charged to hold deposits in the banks. That's where it takes us, right? And What's interesting is that as interest rates come down, banks find it harder and harder to lend because they can't make a turn on the margin between deposits and loans. So they're less likely to lend rather than more likely to lend. And in fact, what the banks end up doing is doing more speculative deals in the derivatives market or more speculative deals around wealth management because there are actually better returns to be made there. So there was a report published quite recently by the Bank for International Settlements that said these low interest rates aren't working and it's creating more financial pressure in the banking system. And yet the Fed's still doing it, the Bank of England's still doing it, Bank of Japan's doing it, we're about to start doing it. It's absolutely nuts. And it's because central banks have groupthink. They have this model as the way that the economy works, which is wrong. And essentially, they just keep printing more and more and more, lifting the value of everything and creating no value. And real households are being hit. So, you know, if you look at depositors, they're getting almost nothing now. These days, it's very hard for depositors to get any sort of return. There are 3 million households in Australia reliant on deposits for income to live, and they are being squeezed. Mortgage holders can actually get a mortgage with a lower interest rate, but that inflates house prices. So one of the reasons why we've got a house price bubble in Australia is because the lending has been so loose. People can get big mortgages. As they get big mortgages, it pushes house prices up. That then inflates bank balance sheets, which allow them to lend more. And so this sort of virtuous cycle or vicious cycle, depending on how you look at it, is there as well. And central banks are not controlling the money supply. Their central banks are not controlling interest rates correctly. And that's why we're in the situation we're in. And it's a one-way street. So nobody has figured a way to go the other way, to start putting interest rates up. Because if you start putting interest rates up, then basically people will get into huge difficulty in terms of the debts they've got. And the Fed a couple of years ago tried to put rates up, did it for a few months. The market then started crashing and they were forced to reverse course and we're now on our cutting rates again. So the markets, big banks, are actually in control of this. And I think that the central banks probably are not so powerful as perhaps they think they are. So they think they're omnipotent and can just print more and cut rates. The truth is that this is actually a one-way street to nowhere.
The Austrian School of Economics, they've developed what's known as the Austrian theory of the business cycle, which also we've talked about the fact that inflation robs ordinary households, privileges the banks and the stockbrokers. But the idea of printing money is to keep the economy growing. But the Austrian business cycle theory says that, as you said, it's a phony boom. And they use the analogy that you think you've got all the materials to build a house, but you actually don't. And you're halfway through and you realize, oh, I don't have this. The house can't be completed. And by the central banks printing more money, inflating, keeping interest rates low, it just delays the crash and, in fact, makes it even worse. And the Austrians believe that even if a credit squeeze, as it's called, raising the rates dramatically, even though there is short-term pain and it can cripple a lot of people, the economy resets, and even in 6 months' time, the economy can have a natural boom again, which does not fake.
Yeah, well, so what's happened is that we should have had a correction in 2008. We never had it. We never got the real correction we needed, right? The central banks around the world and the Fed particularly basically have been supporting this momentum for another decade. And what we've now got is a bigger set of crises, a bigger set of issues. So we've got this bigger and bigger and bigger problem. We've pulled a whole bunch of investments forward and people buying when they should have been buying, 5 years down the track. So we've created this completely disequilibrium in the marketplace. And if you look at real businesses aren't investing. The stock markets are up because firms around the world are borrowing cheap and then they're buying back their own shares to lift their share price. This is why the stock market's rising. They're not investing in real good, development for the future. So effectively, we are creating this financialization of the banking system, the financialization of the business community. And this is a one-way street to nowhere. And the problem is central banks think they've got this all under control and they think they're, you know, fine. But look at the repo markets. Look at what the Fed is still doing, right, despite the fact they thought it was just a little blip last September. $600 billion later, they're still writing more because they can't stop.
And I mentioned Trump. He's openly encouraging the Fed to cut and ease. And this is the other thing that the politics of the day also influencing monetary policy, because Trump has made the vast pitch of his re-election that the economy is booming, unemployment is low, but he knows that if there's a recession, he's cooked. He'll be blamed for it. His credibility for the last 4 years will be wiped out. And Trump might know this deep down in himself that this bubble is unsustainable, but he wants to be re-elected to become a two-term president. And this sort of re-election strategy has been used before by US presidents and Nixon in 72, where we were talking about gold before. Gold used to be tied to, well, gold backed up the paper money. Nixon severed in 72 the Bretton Woods Accord, the final link that the US dollar had to gold, and that was basically to secure his re-election in 72, which he did. So there would be this phony boom, and what happened a year later? OPEC, and then there was the age of Aquarius, the inflation and unemployment stagflation, as it was called.
Yeah, well, you know, the fact of the matter is that the way that the central banks and the governments around the world have been running the economy for the last decade plus, it is myopic. It is very much a case of just saying, let's cut taxes. So if you look at corporate taxes, they've been cut around the world. Trump cut big in the US to, you know, stimulate the economy. The consumer data in the US is not bad, so there's still some evidence of consumer spending, and wages are moving a little higher, so that's good. But like I said, the real issue is that a lot of the corporates there are zombies. They're actually just growing simply because they're borrowing cheap and buying back stocks, so it's not real. And I wouldn't be surprised if Trump announces another policy before the election in the next few months, you know, maybe in relation to coronavirus, to say what we should do is actually take taxes even lower, because that will be another stimulant and another sort of sugar hit, which could actually come in just at the time ahead of the election. As you're right, though, if in fact the economy is tanking in September, October, November, he's going to have great difficulty in being re-elected.
Now, there has been speculation, forecasts and fears of a Australian recession and a global recession. Australia's Treasurer Josh Frydenberg today released the last quarter economic figures, which ends in December, which the economy grew by 0.5%, which is racks up 29 years of consecutive growth of the Australian economy, because we haven't had a recession since 1991, Paul Keating's The Recession that we had to have. But obviously that doesn't count in January, when the bushfires really hit, and of course coronavirus. And we were mentioning the Australian Reserve Bank sort of stepping in to, because they're Frydenberg and Morrison, they don't want to blow the budget surplus. They announced it last year. The politics of it, they know that Wayne Swan in 2012 announced 4 years of surpluses happening, and so they don't want to do what Wayne Swan did. But then the bushfires have happened, and then the coronavirus, and now they're talking about a balanced budget, maybe a slight deficit there. There's been intense pressure, a lot of it from the media and the commentariat, for them to blow the budget surplus. Just to fill our audience in on why a budget surplus is so important because, well, even was it Dick Cheney, the Republican vice president, said back in the 2000s, deficits don't matter. So why are surpluses important and low debt?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I mean, it was, as you say, it became an iconic thing, right? And in fact, if you think about it, 6 months ago, they didn't think they were going to win the election, right? So in a way, saying we're going to end up with a surplus next year was an easy thing to say because basically they probably expect to be in opposition. And then suddenly, bingo, they they weren't. They were actually in power. So that's the first point to make. The second is that there is a fundamental debate going on. And on one end, you've got people called MMT, so the modern monetary theorists, who basically say, look, don't think of governments the same way as households. Governments can create as much debt as they want if it can be created for useful purposes. For example, universal income is one that they're quite keen on. Another one is to actually stimulate so that everybody can get a job if they want to get a job. Those are some of the platforms. Bernie Sanders in the US is running on MMT type sort of doctrines at one end of the spectrum, through to the other that says, actually, the thing about deficits is you have to borrow. If you're borrowing, then you have to pay it back, firstly, and secondly, you have to pay it back at interest. Now, interest rates are very low at the moment, so people would argue that with interest rates so low, governments can actually borrow big and it's not an issue, so maybe it's a good time to borrow. Others will say, no, we still have to get back to a balanced budget because that gives us agility and flexibility and a bit of insulation if we have a crisis. We have a crisis now, of course, and I suspect they'll have to go into deficit to do some of the rescue work that needs to be done, because there are lots of businesses at the moment with cash flow issues. They're just not getting money through the door because they can't sell their products, they can't manufacture their products because they can't get the supply chains to work. That means that if those businesses go under or slow, they'll stop paying income, they'll stop paying wages, in other words, income to their employees, and that will then have a significant negative impact on the broader economy. So it's tricky times. I don't think that Frydenberg and Morrison really in their hearts now believe they will get a surplus, even a small one. They might do. Nobody quite knows how long the coronavirus thing's going to go on for. My own view is this is going to be months, not weeks. This is going to be definitely negative for GDP. And it could be that we see the negative. But the other point to make is that we have 300,000 new migrants coming to Australia each year. And on that basis, it is blooming hard to have a recession number as a GDP number, because the economy is being inflated all the time with more people coming in and more people working. And so that's one of the key reasons. And in fact, one of the big feds, in the St. Louis Fed in the US, did a paper quite recently that said Australia will never have a recession. And the reason Australia will never have a recession is because migration is so strong. And so we could argue that our QE for the last decade plus has not been the same as in other countries. It's been driven by strong levels of migration to inflate the number of people working, to inflate, everything. And frankly, that's why we've got so much congestion in Sydney, Melbourne and elsewhere, right? It's part of the ongoing sort of problem we have. And if you look at per capita metrics, like per capita GDP, that's 0.2 this last quarter, per capita metrics are nowhere near as good as the total number. Because effectively we're growing the pie because of migration, but it's not necessarily an effective pie. So those are some of the things to bear in mind. My own view is it's very unlikely that we're going to be able to end up with a surplus when we come to the May budget.
You raised an important point there, because our high annual migration intake, we've talked about QE, but you could call this PE, people easing. We're inflating our GDP through our migration intake, and governments love it because they pay tax and it props up the budget. But it's like a Ponzi scheme as well, because you mentioned the congestion in Sydney and Melbourne. Obviously, Gladys Berejiklian and Daniel Andrews say, we've built all these schools and hospitals and roads and light rail, which is that's been such a success, but that's only to keep up with the people coming in. And of course, we've also got an aging population. It's completely unsustainable. A Ponzi scheme is where people pay in and the money's moved. There's no real return on investment. And so this is another crisis. And with the coronavirus, with the travel ban from China, of course, that's going to significantly hit us.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've done some modelling on the economic impact of coronavirus, and it's significant. You know, education, of course, is badly hit. Tourism is badly hit. But the real issues is to do with supply chains. People can't get the parts they need to build things, and they can't ship those to other places to sell them when they're completed. So this is a huge, complicated, you know, a very, very wicked problem. The other point that's worth just reflecting on is that we've known about a lot of this dependency on China for a long, long time. So if you look at the way that our economy works, we are very strongly linked to China, whether it's iron ore, whether it's coal, whether it's agricultural sector things too. And so there's this real problem that we've got this very strong link that's been created. And I think we've been made too dependent, firstly. Secondly, our industry is very narrowly based. So effectively, we dig up minerals and chuck them across to China. We do a lot of services stuff, but services stuff is not necessarily value adding relative to some of the other things. Our manufacturing base has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And we don't have an economy, therefore, that is actually very well balanced at all. Highly exposed in terms of its base, highly exposed in terms of the markets. And it's quite likely that we're going to see significant negativity ahead. The other point here is the migration is interesting. I'm doing an interview today, in fact, which will go up on my channel, Walk the World, probably tomorrow or the next day, with an academic who said, do you realize that migrants are young when they come in? But once they're here, they have a tendency then to bring their parents in. And they bring the rest of their family in. And so what you end up doing is, whilst the initial migration is quite young and positive, later the migration actually changes and you end up with more older people who need to be supported. So in fact, from a overall value connecting perspective, you get initial value with young people coming in and working for not very much. But in fact, the fact they then bring in a whole bunch of other people and hangers on means that we actually end up with a demographic problem. We've already got a diabolical demographic problem as people age already, and it's going to get worse. So to my mind, we should be looking very hard at this whole migration model.
A lot of people have talked about with the coronavirus impact that this is the downside of globalization, which we've been told for so long has been the way of the future, comparative advantage. And obviously there's the other extreme, which is autarky, where you produce everything yourself, which is also unsustainable. Obviously it is good to trade globally, but we didn't need to lose all our manufacturing. A lot of that was shooting ourselves in the foot with regulations, red and green tape, the unions demanding too much. And the same with our agriculture and water. Like, the drought that we have is a man-made drought. The farmers know how to work the land, but we've crippled them, and climate policy comes into this as well. So we certainly haven't helped ourselves, and we've made ourselves become more exposed because we don't use the minerals that we have. We export it overseas.
Yeah, well, I've said quite often we're a one-trick pony, right? We dig it up, ship it out, rather than actually add value. And if you think about our strategy, you know, they rescued Holden, a few years ago, put huge amounts of money into Holden, right, to maintain the existing manufacturing base in Australia that didn't work. What they should have done was to invest in manufacturing base for electric cars. So there's no future alignment and orientation to the strategies that have been executed for the last 20, 30 years. So we've become more and more dependent on, you know, last centuries, industries and ways of thinking. And yeah, you don't want to manufacture everything here, because of course, there's benefit in specialism and benefit in centers of gravity around expertise. But we need enough of a base to be able to actually build value for the future, because at the moment that value is being massively eroded. And unfortunately, the political cycle is too short. So effectively, they can just throw a little bit of money at a problem and then, you know, hopefully get re-elected, rather than taking a more strategic view. So my own view, I'm a philosopher by training, and I stand back and say, what we're missing is a strategic plan for Australia. We should have had that 20, 30 years ago, that laid out effectively a vision for where we want to get to, rather than just this incremental iterative approach, which basically has led us to narrowing our manufacturing base, narrowing our industrial base, being more dependent on just a very small number of industries, dependent on a very small number of countries. And the globalization wave, as you say, is not all positive. Neither, I think, is turning that completely off. You know, look at Trump, what Trump is doing in places too. There is a balance, but we need a strategy, and we don't have a strategy. We have a lot of very short-term tactical things, and I think that's probably the biggest problem. I'm not sure that strategy and government actually should be in the same sentence.
I mean, look at the ultimate manufacturing disaster that we've had, which is the in defense procurement with the building of the next submarines. And obviously that was highly politicized as well, but now there's problems with the sourcing of parts and that. And we've had a horrid history of defense procurement. The helicopters that were built in the 2000s, they couldn't fly when it rained. And well, a lot of people talk about the US military industrial complex. Ours is non-existent. You need it to a degree. We can't even make our own military equipment, which is why we're so dependent on the US for foreign policy.
Well, that's right. And another one is oil. You know, we don't now refine oil here in Australia, right? And so do you know what our strategic supply is? How many days we have before, if we got cut off in the Middle East, how long it would be before we actually ran out of fuel here?
It's less than 100, isn't it?
it's about a month.
Okay. Which is, well, the thing is with the toilet paper at the moment, we make that here in Australia with oil. It's as you said, if there's a panic on that, then it's not just a shortage because it's overseas, but it's also a geopolitical strategic disaster.
Yeah, and basically what Morrison has done is negotiated quietly with the US that the US would probably bail us out with some oil if we got into difficulty. But, you know, that's not a good policy. And again, it's lack of strategic thinking, right? We just keep giving up little areas and basically just looking for the cheap dollar and the cheap solution rather than actually drawing the bigger picture. You know, Australia was known as being a very innovative and very creative and very problem-solving based country years ago, and we somehow seem to have lost that ability, unfortunately. And I think that's going to cost us a lot, and I do believe that we need different strategies. I personally think there's room for an investment bank. Maybe it's owned by the government or at arm's length from the government, but invest specifically in new capabilities to be able to create, if you like, the next generation of industrial base in Australia, because without it we're not going to go anywhere very far. The trouble is that the commercial banks aren't interested in that because the risks are too high. So we need a different funding model, I think. We need a different commercial model, and we need a different strategy to support it.
Don't we have something sort of like that with the Future Fund that Peter Costello
set but up? No, the Future Fund is all about paying for civil servants' pensions.
That's all it is.
I mean, they invest in various things, but there's very little, you know, there's very little strategic investment in really exciting new things. It's all about creating an income stream so that superannuation for civil servants can be paid.
The US, since I mentioned before, the 1973 OPEC oil crisis, when energy independence was first talked about, and the United States has nearly got there, and they are open now, the deep state neocons, that yes, all those wars were blood for oil. And when there was the Iranian drone attack on the Saudi oil facility, because everyone knows that they're the biggest oil producers there, Trump basically said, don't panic. The US were able to keep up with the supply of oil, and there wasn't a huge spike in the price. Obviously, you mentioned our lack of energy independence, and Iran in the middle of last year seized British oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz, and Australia sent contributed to freedom of navigation exercises in the Strait of Hormuz because, well, our foreign policy experts knew that was important for us.
Yeah, so you've got to decode what's going on there. There's a political agenda, which is about power and who's actually asserting what power where. And then there's the economic agenda, right? Now, of course, the US is now self-sufficient on oil, so they don't need to worry about it for themselves. But they also know that it's important to keep the supply chains open for the broader economy. I think that we're not being told the full story here as to what's going on there. And I have to say that I think there's been at least two or three generations of very bad policy in the Middle East. All of the ructions that we continue to see is actually not the US trying to sort of pour, quote, oil on troubled waters. They've been part of the problem. So I'm less optimistic than many in terms of what we're seeing there. I think this is going to be a troublesome area for a long, long time to come. And what I would say, of course, is that if, in fact, the future is less oil intensive because of climate change, and it probably will be, that could change the geopolitical landscape significantly. So I guess short term, there will be a lot of self-protectionism. Longer term, I wouldn't be surprised to see that changing. And it's interesting, of course, that OPEC and non-OPEC countries are talking now about reducing the oil supply to try and lift the oil price, which has dropped dramatically in the last couple of weeks. It's now sort of mid-40s rather than mid-50s. So they still have some influence and the ability to exert influence. But my feeling is over time, that's going to pale away.
Petrol in Australia, I filled up last night, $1.25 a litre, which is quite cheap to what it has been. So that obviously, your analysis there is true in real life. You mentioned protectionism, and Trump, he ran on a platform that the trade agreements that we have are unfair. He initiated the trade war with China. He renegotiated NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, that is now USMCA, United States, Mexico, Canada agreement, which everybody seems happy with. Even Nancy Pelosi said that, yes, we can't wait to get this ratified. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders said, well, it's still not perfect, but it's better. Obviously, the traditional free market view is these trade wars are destructive. They disadvantage local producers, agriculture. How do you see the Trump's initiation of the trade wars, and he has concluded it with China with a new agreement?
Well, no, he's concluded step one, right? So he's done the easy stuff, right? And that was probably something which was, you know, it took some negotiation, but they haven't really touched the really hard stuff. But I also think Trump had a point insofar that the landscape between China and the rest of the world was very uneven with regard to things like copyright laws, to things with regards to the various tariffs in and out. So he has moved the dial a little bit, but I'm not sure that he's really addressed the fundamental structural issues that actually it represents. And there's also, you know, nobody quite wants to go there because there is a symbiotic relationship still between China and the US, if you look at the amount of trade backwards and forwards. So I think he's got some brownie points, but not many. And look, my perspective on all of this is global trade is part of the way the planet works, but people don't necessarily understand the full consequences of that. They don't understand what it means in terms of the economic flows and in terms of where, you know, where wages are going. One of the reasons why wages are so low is because it's cheaper to get somebody in China to do it rather than, you know, pay for it locally. So there are definitely a lot of issues to worry about. I suspect that we will find that Trump will be quite quiet with regard to the China trade at the moment because of the coronavirus. But if he gets back in after the next election, I would expect a second round. And there they will start tackling some of the more complex issues that will be very difficult to solve. And remember that this is ultimately a geopolitical battle, and it's a battle for who's top dog between the US and China. And I think it's not unfair to assume that China is on the ascendancy, even coronavirus excepted. US is probably on the descendancy. And so who's going to be top dog in 20 years' time? It's more likely to be China and India than the US, in my view.
So what should Trump initiate in this phase two, in your view?
Well, I think that there's this important question about what China is tending to do is to basically steal ideas from other countries and then create cheap copies of them and basically then flog them, right? And, you know, you could argue that Huawei is an example of that. Now, they've taken it further now and they've actually started innovating themselves, but initially that's how Huawei started, right? And so the issue is, can you get international agreements around ideas and how ideas are actually commercialized? That's the first point. The second point is that tariffs and markets need to be open both ways. And so that means that China needs to be more open with regard to its own markets. And yet, of course, it has a very different doctrinal position with regard to market access and market control relative to the US. I'm not sure how they can square those two different worldviews. Maybe they are incompatible. And then the third thing to bear in mind is that China has its Belt and Roads Initiative, which is essentially extending influence out through into Asia, down into areas of Europe and Africa and beyond, and across, you know, broader Asia too. I think the US are quite concerned about that, because what it is doing is giving Asia influence and control, China influence and control across many geographies that traditionally they would not have reached into. So, you know, they've got these massive roadways and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. I don't know whether that is negotiable or not, but I suspect that the US will have something to say about that, because as a sphere of influence, and that's what this is ultimately about, it's a sphere of influence and who wins the sphere of influence, that's what this ultimate discussion is about at a meta level.
And of course, we should also add into this discussion that China is not a free market economy. It's heavily state controlled, is a communist dictatorship, which also influences the trade policy. So it's not like Australia and the United States trade agreement. And economics also goes into geopolitical considerations as well. And as we've seen, that if we're too dependent on globalization, then some government can basically cripple a nation in, 30 days, as you said before.
Yeah. No, I mean, there is a fundamental philosophical difference between the way China does things and the way the US does things. I'm not sure it's as black and white as many portray. I think there are examples where the US exerts its muscle and, you know, pushes its ideas very, very hard. Same with China. Both are quite controlling. Both are actually in name calling the other quite often. I almost put them side by side and say they've got very strong common characteristics. There is a different political system underpinning it, but I don't see them as polar opposites, as some do. I think there are some very strong commonalities, and in a way that's part of the challenge in terms of when they try and engage, because they are quite similar in many ways.
Well, I've enjoyed your excellent economic analysis tonight, Martin. So has our audience as well. One of them said, you're the best guest that I've ever had on Wilma's front. I am looking for a resident economics expert to have on Wilma's front. You might be the man if you've enjoyed and want to come back on.
Yeah, well, no, I'm very happy to. I mean, I spend quite a lot of my time on this stuff. Let me just tell your audience that there is my channel, Walk the World, where there's more than 1,000 shows that we've created over the last few years. And then my other channel is called In the Interest of the People, and that's with John Adams, and that's where we talk about the cash ban and those things. So if you want to check out those channels, feel free. But yeah, I'm happy to come back and spend a bit more time and, you know, answer some questions and look at this stuff. What I believe is really important is to give people exposure to different ideas, different concepts. I'm not saying I know all the right answers, but I'm happy to explore things. And as a philosopher, I'm very interested in the underbelly of ideas and what's really driving them. So if that's relevant to you and your audience, I'm very happy to come back.
Well, that's what this show is. It's an exploration show. And because we've got this extended format, we're not on mainstream media where you've got to go to an ad break every 15 minutes, make everything digestible we can. And that's what you do with your channels as well, which everybody should subscribe to, click the bell to allow notifications, and also your website as well, digitalfinanceanalytics.com.
Yep, absolutely. That's where all my posts go, and all the shows are all up there too. So, no, I enjoyed it, and thanks for the opportunity.
If the past week has shown us anything, consumer behavior is unpredictable. World events, human and non-human origin can throw projected economic forecasts at the window. So we've sort of made our analysis now, but in 3 months' time, could be something completely different.
It'll be wrong and it'll be different, there's no doubt. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Cheers.